The Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. March is Women's History Month, and quite appropriately, we fill the month with shows on women in American history. We'll be looking at a legendary Native American woman, woman in basketball, and a very interesting, some would say unique woman involved in the Civil War. But this week, we kick off the month by looking at one of America's most enduring figures, Harriet Tubman, as slave and anti-slavery leader. I'll be speaking with Catherine Clinton, whose recently published biography has been widely praised as revealing Tubman for the first time as a singular and complex character, a woman who defied simple categorization. After that, Ann Bailey will join us to comment on the African Atlantic slave trade. And Kelly Schrum will wrap things up by telling us about a virtual site where you can actually hear the voices and testimonies of American slaves. But first, as we do every week, let's take a look at a few items of historical interest in the news that you may have missed. First, an update. Some time ago, I reported on the reopening of the investigation into the case of Emmett Till, the 14-year-old Chicagoan who was murdered 50 years ago in Mississippi. Till, who had gone to Mississippi to visit relatives, was tortured and murdered for whistling at a white woman. His body was brought back to his hometown, but before he was buried, his mother, Mamie Till Mobley, insisted that the nation see what had been done to her son. She had Emmett's mutilated body placed in an open casket in Robert's Temple Church of God in Christ, where tens of thousands of mourners filed by and photographs were taken and published in newspapers across the nation. Historians call that event in 1955 one of the most significant early statements about civil rights. But the church was all but forgotten until recent events prompted a group of city activists to turn Temple Church into a historic landmark. "This is part of the civil rights trail," said Jonathan Fine, president of Preservation Chicago. "The civil rights trail begins in Chicago, and it began in this church. The historic designation process is expected to be completed in the next few months." And the Associated Press reports that we have a new translation of the Bible. More than 25 years after the work began, the New Testament has been translated into Gullah, the Creole language spoken by slaves and their descendants for generations along the Sea Islands of the southeast coast. Gullah is an oral language, so the translation was more difficult than usual. It began in 1979 when a team of Gullah speakers who worked with Pat and Claude Sharp, translation consultants with Wycliffe Bible Translators, to bring out this new edition. Many efforts have been made over the years to preserve Gullah, which mixed West African languages with English, and historians believe that the translated Bible will be a major contribution toward that goal. About 250,000 Gullahs still live in the American Southeast. When we return, I'll be speaking with Catherine Clinton about Harriet Tubman, and Ann Bailey will comment on the Atlantic slave trade. This is Talking History. If you're tired, keep going. If you're scared, keep going. If you're hungry, keep going. If you want to taste freedom, keep going. This was the mantra by which Harriet Tubman lived. Tubman is one of the most enduring figures in American history, the legendary conductor on the Underground Railroad who was known as Moses to her followers and admirers. But she was denied a scholarly biography, one that rediscovers the real woman from the legend, for half a century, or until our guest this week put pen to paper. Her name is Catherine Clinton. Clinton, a Princeton Ph.D., has authored more than 15 books, her most recent of which is Harriet Tubman, The Road to Freedom, published by Back Bay Books of Little Brown and Company. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you, Brian.
Good to have you. Now, Harriet Tubman led many lives, and I think that's one of the more interesting parts about this book, is she just wasn't the conductor on the Underground Railroad, about which most of us know. But let's review her life and accomplishments, taking sort of one role at a time. And let's start by her life as a slave in Maryland, beginning with her birth. Tell us about that.
Well, we live in a culture where we're worried about children and their struggles, and we want no children left behind. But certainly the slave women were bearing children that were left behind in poverty and in struggle. And really, the life of a child was nasty, brutish. Harriet did live in the upper South rather than the deep South, where children were often sold off at the age of six to go work on the expanding plantation frontier. Because what we know now about American slavery is that the diaspora was within the United States, where hundreds of thousands were sent out onto the frontier. And she lived on the eastern shore of Maryland, which was where Georgia traders would come every fall and buy slaves and send them, quote, down the river. And it was a great fear of her childhood that men on horses might come in and scoop her up and send her away from her family, which happened, of course, to two of her sisters who were part of the disappeared. So the life of a slave child was very harsh. You were put into the fields at an early age. You were sent out. We believe from the age of five, she was put into a white household and asked to tend a baby. And if the baby cried in the night, the mother, rather than going to her child, would take a switch and whip Harriet because it was her job to keep the baby quiet at night. So all of these very, very harsh roles were put upon a slave child. Harriet was resistant to that and indeed was resistant to white supervision. She preferred to work outdoors. She preferred to be in the fields. And we know that she was able to do a man's work from a very early age.
Interesting. Age five. That's pretty incredible. She escaped, though. She was a fugitive. Tell us about that.
We know that she left Maryland in 1849. We believe she was born about 1825. We don't have birth dates, hospital records, etc. But she later testified twice in a government deposition that she was born in 1825. In 1849, something very momentous happened, and that was her owner died. So she was afraid that she would be scattered, that her family would go to the four corners of the nation and be gone. And so she decided to seek her own freedom. There are many stories surrounding this escape, but we do know that she had some help. A white woman in particular was meant to give her some help. We know that she was given a piece of paper with a name on it. Since she was illiterate and remained illiterate even after she escaped slavery, we know that it was meant to pass on to someone to know that it was safe to try and seek help. There were Quakers, there were abolitionists dotting the pathway from Maryland up to freedom in Philadelphia. And Philadelphia was really the magnet. And that's where she escaped to and got her freedom.
Okay, and that's a good segue perhaps to her role on the Underground Railroad. And I think you've already suggested it, but, you know, very briefly summarize how it worked and what it meant to be a conductor and then perhaps move into what Harriet herself did as part of the Underground Railroad.
To be a conductor, you were someone who would take an escaped or liberated slave, a self-liberated slave, from one depot, one safe house, to another. This could involve just going a journey of a few miles or moving someone within a town. And we know that there were many whites and blacks who were engaged in this clandestine activity. We also know there were stiff penalties. People were put in jail for this. There were many martyrs, ministers. Charles Torrey, who was a minister who helped slaves, was a conductor, was put in jail and died there. So there were many people participating in this. But Harriet was the first and only woman, the only black, and one of the few fugitives to work as an abductor. Now, I didn't use that term in my book, Harriet Tubman, The Road to Freedom, because abductions do not have very attractive kinds of associations. But the abductors were those people who would actually go from freedom behind enemy lines into the slave South and spirit people to freedom. And this was a very, very rare role. We only have a handful of histories of these abductors, and we know about their histories mainly because they were caught and put in jail. And of course, Harriet was never caught. In later life, she said, "I never lost a passenger." So she was very proud of her work and her secrecy. And secrecy was the byword for the Underground Railroad. They used signs, they used knocks, they used a lot of clandestine activity. I think much has been made about quilts recently, and we don't really have the evidence for that, except we do know that Harriet herself made a quilt as a young woman and traded it to the person who helped her escape to freedom.
Do we have any idea how many trips or abductions, if you will, Harriet took part in?
Well, this is a difficulty because we have lots of oral history from her. As I said, she was illiterate, but she did dictate letters, and we have some of her history recorded by people. I even have a memoir of someone who knew her in the 1890s who took down her story, gave this recitation to a women's club, and I found it on file in Cayuga County in upstate New York, where Harriet later settled. So we don't have exact dates for things. And actually, people get into a lot of dispute around Harriet Tubman Day, which is March 10th every year. There's a great debate over how many people she took, and there's a lot of disputing. And this kind of dispute over the facts of the number of trips and the number of people is something I think that really bogs us down. If she only escaped herself, she was risking death. To come back and take her sister out, and it was her niece who called her sister, but all people. First she escaped with her family, and then she escaped with her brothers. And then she came back and she took out people who were her brothers and sisters in slavery. And we don't have exact numbers. But one of the things I say is we know so much about her Underground Railroad career, and we forget her career during the Civil War. Because for Harriet Tubman, the Civil War was taking the Underground Railroad above ground. And she went south and she took out hundreds. We know in one single night in a Civil War raid, the Cumby River raid, 756 slaves were liberated from southern plantations on June 3rd, 1863. So however many she was able to take out in twos and threes, or maybe as many as 11, because she was really well known for these mass escapes from the Eastern Shore, which appeared in the newspaper, which were lambasted, which there was allegedly a price on her head because she was so fearless and would return again to the same place. So we don't really have exact numbers, but we do have evidence. We do have newspaper accounts. People often ask me, where do you get your evidence? Where do you find evidence? How do we know that Harriet Tubman really escaped in 1849? And I tell the story of a local researcher who saw a home being emptied out in 2003. And he went to the owner and said, can I look in the dumpster? And in that dumpster, this local researcher found a newspaper which was missing from the National Archives, missing from the Maryland Archives, missing from the Talbot County collection of local Maryland newspapers. And there was, in black and white, a runaway ad for Harriet Tubman, and it was discovered in 2003, and it was the, quote, evidence, the, quote, documentation. Now, Harriet told people she escaped in 1849, and I, for one, would take her testimony, but it's nice to have the evidence, and I just say to people who want to know, where are my documents? I say, they'll turn up, maybe in a dumpster, maybe in a library, but we as historians have to take our evidence where we can find it. And working on something like the Underground Railroad, or even working on the Civil War, certainly her folkloric role is important, but we need to look at the testimony and the letters. And people collected everything during that period and held on to it. So we find letters, materials turning up hundreds of years later on this very important epoch in American history.
I want to make a connection here for our listeners. Not too long ago, we interviewed David Reynolds on his new book on John Brown. And he mentions in his book, and of course you develop in yours, the meeting between Tubman and Brown in 1858. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think it was so important because Tubman was also someone who had visions and dreams. We don't know where her kinds of prophetic visions came from. She did suffer a very serious childhood injury. She did her entire life suffer from a disability where she would, quote, lose time. We don't have medical records. One of the things she said she saw was a snake on the ground in one of her dreams, and it rose up. And then a group of men came in and attacked the snake, but the snake was a face of an old man. And when she met John Brown in Canada in 1858, because Canada was the destination for escaped slaves after the Fugitive Slave Act in 1850, she was afraid to leave people in the north and took them under the paw of the lion, which was the way she referred to British protection in Canada. And John Brown had heard about her, and he came up there, and it was quite a meeting. He saw that she was a warrior, and he tutored her that slavery is war. Slavery is the taking of life. Slavery is a battle, and she should engage in it. And his plan to attack Harper's Ferry was one that Frederick Douglass was very reticent about, refused to participate in, as did the more than scores. We know at least 40 or 50 people knew about the raid in advance. Tubman did want to participate, but she actually was ill at the time, and Brown kept postponing the raid, and of course it was a disaster because he didn't have Harriet Tubman scouting. He didn't have her spying in the countryside. He didn't have her winning over the people ahead of time. But when he died, most people valued him as a martyr. But Harriet Tubman always regretted the loss of a comrade who she felt would really help her win the war against slavery.
Is it your impression that then she would have supported in some real way this act of violence?
Absolutely, because she saw violence, as I pointed out, on the eastern shore of Maryland. She saw children withering and dying. She saw children being sold away. She saw the harshness and cruelty of everyday life. She saw people beaten to death. Actually, there were slave traders during that period. It was quite amazing that on the eastern shore, in the next county, a house was discovered that had bones in the yard, and they discovered chains, and that people were illegally going up to Philadelphia, grabbing blacks off the street, bringing them down, and chaining them up and selling them into Virginia and into slavery. And this great folkloric tale was part of her childhood, that the cruelty and harshness of slavery. So yes, I believe by the 1850s, she had well thought it was a war. And yet, we have to look and see that she was in Canada helping refugees make a new life. So she saw part of the war, the reconstruction of life. And indeed, she was well prepared when the war broke out in 1861 and went to Fort Monroe in Virginia and began to help the escape slaves that were coming there, who were called contraband, and was indeed doing an important role in terms of nursing and care. But this led to a warrior role when the governor of Massachusetts sent her down to Port Royal in South Carolina in 1862. And her role expanded. While she was down there, she helped escape slaves in South Carolina during the Port Royal experiment. But when James Montgomery, who had been one of Brown's lieutenants out on the Kansas frontier, came in the spring of 1863, and he followed Higginson, who came from Massachusetts, who knew her through abolitionist circles, and where these two white officers of black regiments got there, they said, we need to use Tubman for what she can do for us. She was a spy. She was a scout. She took river pilots and found where the mines were laid in the river, and she began to do military work for Rufus Saxton and David Hunter, the generals in charge of the Department of the South.
The war brought an end to slavery. It released the 13th Amendment in 1865. Was Tubman therefore unemployed, or what did she do after the war ended?
Well, I think what's important to see is that the Civil War was a triumph for her. It was something that she championed. But at the same time, she was battling a war against injustice. And she, as a woman warrior, also battled the war, which women were disabled in that society. So she was a very strong supporter of women's suffrage. She was a very strong supporter of the freedmen's cause. And she felt, rightly, that when she was able to be discharged from her military service and to go home, she was actually on a train going through New Jersey on her way to Auburn, New York, and upstate, where she had settled with her family from her work in the South. And she presented her pass, which was a military pass, to the conductor. And the railroad conductor looked at this and said, but you're a black woman. You can't possibly be a soldier. And she said, I'm a soldier, and I fought, and this is my military pass. It took four men to eject her from her seat. She was physically dragged to a boxcar, where she was kept until she reached her destination. So she then realized the war was not over.
Interesting.
The war would continue a struggle. And in upstate New York, she became known as a reformer. She became someone who local blacks, the indigent, the poor, and especially veterans went to her for help during this period. And indeed, here she was, really a black woman who had been able to buy her own home from Secretary of State William Seward, who had befriended her. And Auburn was his hometown, and he gave her a home at favorable rates, and she was able to purchase that home. But that wasn't enough for her. She wanted a, quote, charity home. So she bought the property next to her and began to take people in to really provide charity for those who were neglected by society. So she was a great humanitarian, and I think her humanitarianism stretches from her earliest years to her latest years. So her life is really a lesson for us. She's an icon for school children. When I encountered her in the late 1980s, 1990s, when I was teaching in the African American Studies Department at Harvard University, and someone asked me to write an encyclopedia article on her. And I went to find biographies on her. And there I was at the library. I checked the Library of Congress, and I discovered an adult biography hadn't been written on her since 1943. And it was written by a journalist who was from Auburn, her hometown. And I thought, this is really, she's a legendary figure. She's an icon. But she deserves our respect, and she deserves a history.
Okay, let me pick up on that a bit, because we only have time for one more question. And it often comes up on this show, whether we're dealing with John Brown or Rosa Parks or whatever. So many of these people just become legends, and the legends become separate from their real lives. And one of the things you try to do in your book is to clarify the legend from the reality of Harriet Tubman's life. If you had to summarize it rather briefly, what would you consider to be the most important issues that need to be dealt with to separate Tubman's legend from reality?
Well, she's seen as someone who was fantastic, almost a superhero, and she appeared in the 1960s during the Black Revolutionary Revival as a Harriet for All Seasons, as someone who would hold a gun and be a fighter. And yet school children would also celebrate her as someone who would help the children. And so she had this very interesting, iconic role that went from extreme right to extreme left, from pacifist to warrior. I think one of the things we need to see about her was that she's so appealing to children, and I think she should be appealing in the 21st century as one person who stood up, who had faith in herself and also faith in justice. And she said, I can make a difference. I will make a difference. This will be my struggle. This will be my life. And I think in the 21st century, that kind of courage, that kind of amazing grace, which she spread throughout her life, is something that I think we should carry with us, we should celebrate, and we should make Harriet Tubman really a hero in this era of heroes.
Well put. I think that's where we're going to have to leave it. So let me thank you for joining us, Catherine.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Catherine Clinton, the author of Harriet Tubman, The Road to Freedom, published by Back Bay Books of Little Brown and Company. This is Talking History.
I was 5 years old in Bucktown, Maryland. Went into slavery, I was sent. I'll tell you of the beatings and of the fighting in my 93 years I spent.
Ann Bailey is the author of a new book on American slavery. It's titled African Voices of the Atlantic Slave Trade, Beyond the Silence and Shame. And as the title suggests, in the book she tells the story of the slave trade from the slave's perspective. Bailey joins us now to read to us a section of her book.
In southern Ghana, along the stretch of land off the Atlantic coast, formerly known as the Old Slave Coast, now known as Awiland, on many a night, the striking rhythms of the drums can be heard from many miles away. They are so sure, so insistent in telling their story. With the Awe talking drum leading the pack, stories of long ago are revealed one by one. Yet we do not know the whole story. Here and on the other side of the Atlantic, in fact, wherever people of African descent are to be found, there is a deafening silence on the subject of slavery and the Atlantic slave trade. All that remains are fragments which, like the scattered pieces of a broken vase, do not represent the whole. Under the silence are palpable sighs of regret, pain, sorrow, guilt, and shame. Historians and others have been engaged in debates and analyses of the effects of the trade on African societies for decades. Nevertheless, the story of the trade has rarely been told from the perspective of those who suffered the most. What remains to be done is the placing of African voices of this era at the center of any historical enterprise. No full and thorough analysis of African records, in particular oral records, has been attempted. This was, then, the main motivation for my study, African Voices of the Atlantic Slave Trade. Also integral to this study is my own personal history or position vis-a-vis the silences in the history of slavery. My origins, as is the case with far too many people of African descent, are shrouded in mystery. Though my ancestors were likely slaves, I do not know their names. I do not know their port of embarkation in Africa, nor do I know their port of entry in Jamaica. My family history does not begin from the beginning, as one would normally expect. Instead, it largely centers around my grandfather, David Cohen Barnaby Ramsey. Born December 28, 1885, D.C.B. Ramsey was a teacher's teacher and was said to have been a formidable man in his day. Born to a visionary mother named Bathsheba and David Sr., a farmer, in the rural village of Middle Quarters in the parish of St. Elizabeth, Jamaica, D.C.B. Ramsey was destined from an early age to move beyond the confines of his little village. When he was just a boy, so the story goes in my family, Bathsheba looked beyond the small farms and the surrounding hills of Middle Quarters to a school on a hill called Full Neck and said, "You see that school? You will teach there one day." And teach there he did. He later took positions as a headmaster at schools in Porus, Nazareth, Magaty, and other areas around the island. But beyond this more recent family history, who were the family ancestors, and where did they hail from? Why do only fragments of our story remain? These are some of the issues I explore in the African diaspora and on the African continent in the book African Voices of the Atlantic Slave Trade, Beyond the Silence and the Shame.
You've been listening to Anne C. Bailey reading from her new book, African Voices of the Atlantic Slave Trade, Beyond the Silence and Shame, published by Beacon Press. Bailey is also a professor of history at Spelman College. This is Talking History. And finally, to conclude this week's show on Harriet Tubman and American slavery, Kelly Shrum is here to report on a virtual site where you can actually hear the voices of American slaves. Shrum is the assistant director of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University.
Former slave George Johnson explained how he was named as an infant. "I got my name from President Jeff Davis. He was president of the Southern Confederacy. He owned my grandfather and my father." Another former slave, Fountain Hughes, told interviewers about his experience in slavery. "You wasn't no more than a dog to some of them in them days. You wasn't treated as good as they treat dogs now. But still, I didn't like to talk about it, because it makes people feel bad, you know." This site captures the recollections of 23 former slaves, born between 1823 and the early 1860s. Several of the people interviewed were more than 100 years old, the oldest being 130 at the time of the interview. In the recording, subjects discuss their entire lives, including their years as slaves, and they provide an important perspective on what life was like for slaves and freedmen. The interviewees discuss how they felt about slavery and slaveholders, their families, and, of course, freedom. Each testimony is presented in four formats: real audio, MP3, wave, and transcription. Many of the subjects sang as part of their testimony, and these songs are available as well. A gallery presents faces and voices from the presentation section, and Essays offers biographical information on the interviewers, including Zora Neale Hurston and Alan Lomax. To locate this site, visit historymatters.gmu.edu. Type emancipated into the keyword search.
And that's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beatty is our producer and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thank you for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.